Hello world, we are back. It's been a long time, but I've been nudged by two people, Dave. Two whole people have said, why the hell don't you do a 99th podcast anymore? I've got nothing to listen to. And I think, you know, if you take that two people and multiply that by around 4 billion, because, you know, statistical impurities and whatnot, then realistically, you know, sort of at least 4 to 6 billion people want this podcast back. So we've got to give the fans what they want.
I think you're about right. I mean, well, was it 6 degrees of separation that you're separated by a personal connection to everybody on Earth by six people or less?
Exactly.
So if you just tell six of your mates that you enjoyed this, then everyone on Earth will listen to it. So
exactly.
Hello, planet Earth.
Yeah, we're back. There's a lot that has changed. The 99s had a great season last year. We're back again. We're going to talk about some rugby. We've got some exciting new directions for the pod to sort of help promote things again and get things going. So let's dive right into it, Dav. What is new? What's going on? What's on the agenda?
Well, I think most people will probably know exactly what's coming. Probably the most big rugby news story that's happened, at least everybody who's in the know about rugby over the last 30 years.
Yeah.
The RFU's announced the new tackle laws for basically amateur rugby, national one and below. Every tackle must be below waist high or will be a high tackle. A lot of controversy, a lot of immediate and fierce backlash. So let's talk about it, Dan. First of all, what are your thoughts?
My personal thoughts on it when it came out, I think, is pretty much the same as what I'd say 99% of the people involved in the game was, in terms of just the sheer shit show of communication, really. It was really bad, you know, really poorly done. You know, you hear stories coming out about the members who were attended didn't even have an agenda point for this. They basically watched a 10-minute video and then were told to vote on it. They weren't actually sure what they were voting on. It wasn't clear. So when you look at it like that from an RFU perspective, it's really, really disappointing that you think a incredibly well-run organization, or at least what you'd assume is a well-run organization, handles things in that kind of way. So I think that was the big thing. I think it was just the sheer disappointment, and also the fact that, you know, a lot of this research isn't really ratified yet. It's not even finished for the most part. So, you know, it's difficult to really say that this is going to fix anything either way. It's difficult to say whether it's going to make it worse or make it better. You know, the Championship had to cap off their study because they found that actually more people were getting injured. I've heard things coming out of France that the results have been skewed somewhat, and, you know, there's been some pretty bad practices happening off the field. So I think on the actual side of the decision making, it's been really, really disappointing. But I can see why they're doing it. You know, there's a huge uproar at the moment with people putting in claims, you know, and let's be honest, we both know that rugby, albeit, you know, you filter them out, you can make quite a bit of money. I don't think rugby can afford to have thousands of lawsuits coming up against them for players claiming damages for concussions, you know, at amateur level, let alone professional level. So I think I can understand why they're doing it. They're trying to cover their back for future process to show, look, hey, we're trying to do something here. But I also think at the end of the day, I don't see it necessarily being the right thing to do. I think the laws that are already in place, you know, tackling below the shoulder, anything around the head is bad. I think it's more of addressing a technique sort of thing. I think that's the way to go. I think we need to have potentially professional players and coaches get into community clubs and do tackling masterclasses and defense masterclasses as well, because defense is a part of the game where it's just all about get up with your line speed and whatnot. And that's great because it's pressure, turnovers, etc. But with that also comes a lack of control. And that's where I think a lot of your high shots will come in. If you're rushing up as a hard line and someone puts a last minute sidestep to the side, automatically you're going to find it hard to change your body height in time to make a successful hit. So there's definitely perhaps something on a laws perspective that could change to negate that. But I would much prefer going down the route of actually trying to better train our players and coaches for how we're approaching things like defense and the tackle, and also looking at our off-field practices around concussion, rather than trying to, you know, make a law change that really kind of appeases a very, very small minority of people who just sort of make a lot of noise.
I think when I first heard about it initially, it sounded a bit drastic. And I think a lot of people as well, it's important to remember the waist is not the hips, it is like above the belly button, it's higher up than you think. But so it's not And if you're tackling textbook, as it were, you know, how you're taught as a kid, where you should be aiming to hit, it is a good tackle. But as you've just said, you know, on the fly in a game, situational, that is almost impossible to do.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found interesting, so they spoke about the Championship Cup trial, where basically it was not, the rule wasn't communicated at all. It was interpreted by all the coaches and players that any tackle has got to be below, I think it was below the sternum, was it they tried?
It was like nipple, sternum height, something like that.
So ball carriers taking the ball in, as often do, like off nine, crash balls, very low to the ground. So the only way to get under that part of the body is to get even lower yourself, and you're putting your head into shoulders, into knees, into that hips, that kind of territory for the tackler themselves to get injured. Yeah. And I think they found out they actually had a massive increase in concussions because of this. Mm. What they didn't take into consider is basically, you know, pulling someone down who's overbalanced like that, or them coming into your chest. If there's head on chest or torso contact, is the tackler at fault? That was never addressed. It had a problem. I think people immediately see this headline, and that's what they're imagining is going to happen straight away, that those tackles all of a sudden become a penalty, which, you know, does kill the game. It's going to kill the game. There's no, if that is how the law is implemented, safety aside, I know safety is very, very important, arguably the most important thing, but you're actually taking that away and you're going to kill the game. You make it more dangerous, and you're going to have, you know, 75 penalties a game for a high tackle that's unavoidable. But what I will say, something that changed my mind somewhat, because I thought when it came out, of all, the thinking is in the right place. This is a big problem they need to do something about. And not just the RFU, World Rugby need to do something about. Mm-hmm. How do you take some head injury risk out of the game? It's impossible to take it all out. You can't possibly avoid injury risk, because it's any sport you can get injured. You can get injured running, you can get injured lifting weights very easily. And head injury is part of your body. Playing any contact sport or any sport at all, you can get a bang on the head. But it's all those little hits that people are taking, I think, that are causing the problem. You can't take that risk out. They need to do something that can mitigate this risk.
I think it's much more of a culture thing rather than an issue with the game. I think, like I say, it's changing the way that teams defend and changing individual players' attitudes. You know, when they get off the line, your body should already be set quite low. You should already have a slight bend at the hips as you're coming up, because that way you are still mobile to change your weight balance and stuff like that. But also you're set to make a low tackle. The issue that I see in and the great thing about the elite game was, obviously, is we, any kind of decision like this, we get to see the video footage over and over and over again, and people boo and hiss until someone gets a red card. I'd say probably, I guess, at least 80% of those hits that I'm seeing is either someone who's flew up out the line, and if a ball carrier catches the ball a bit awkwardly and kind of dips, they hit them in the head, or if someone stepped across and the second defender's coming in to make, you know, a bit of a jam kind of tackle. It's because they're not already set a little bit low at the hips. So one thing that I always do when I come up is I stay kind of low, because, you know, it's just a way for me to be low already to kind of make a low tackle. And I find with that, then if someone does drop their height, at least I can keep going. Whereas if I come bolt upright, I'm only ever going to have a chance to drop my height a tiny bit. So I think it's more of a culture thing about how we defend and how people approach defense. And then I think I would prefer to see the RFU invest in making changes there, and also making changes in the practices. Like I said, you know, identification of concussion, because the one argument I would make is, yes, I think the numbers from the numbers that were involved in all of this, I think it was something like this. What was it? There was four or five concussions a weekend or something in the Premiership and the elite game, and that drops to, you know, by 25% in the community game. So you think about it, there's a concussion every maybe eight games or something like that in a 20 odd game season. It's not that much, really, when you think about it like that, across an entire, you know, 30 odd thousand teams, or however many teams there are out there. But how many of those are unidentified? How many of those are a guy who, you know, gets a bit of a blinky-blinky, flashy-flashy? There's only a single physio who's, you know, running up and down the touchline who maybe doesn't see the symptoms. How then do we make sure that that person's okay? You know, we heard about the spit test stuff. What happened to that? That's gone completely silent. Why has the RFU not gone, hey, how much is this? Could we send this out to all the clubs and do a test? See how accurate this is at identifying concussions? And then, as you mentioned, be really stringent on the protocols for that. I know you mentioned before we sort of started recording around the new GMS, the game management system the RFU has. It should be that if someone has a concussion, you have to log it in there. And there's a mandatory 21 days that are on there, and you have to report in and fill stuff in. You know, why can't a club physio do that, or a club doctor if you're a championship club that has that or something like that? Why can't they be involved in that to kind of make that decision?
And also referees are there. Yeah. They mark down the score of the game. They're the ones who say to the RFU, this is what the score was.
Yeah.
It's just they have to log a head injury. If someone comes off with a suspected head injury, the referee has to take the details down like they would for a red card or whatever.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think these things would make a bigger difference than trying to change the law, because the one risk and the one thing that everyone is saying, you know, the tall guys who struggle to get low, they're going to be heck out of the game. The guys, you know, the 45, 50-year-old vets who, bless them, can't get down too low anymore, they're not hitting with loads of force anyway. I'd probably say the risk of concussion in a vet's game is minimal now.
We're tackle talking... is minimum in a vet's game.
Exactly. It's defense optional, isn't it? So that's what we're looking at there. And I think when you then put that in a setting of sevens, if that goes into rugby sevens, Rugby sevens is so hard to defend anyway. You need those kind of ability to grab someone and drag them down, because missed tackles equal tries. You know what I mean? So it's creating a scenario. And I know we want to see a more expansive attacking game, but I think there's other ways to do that. You know, this is not going to... I know they've said, it's going to make more offloads and stuff like that. But realistically, probably not, because dominant low tackles, people end up on their back anyway. So you're telling me that if someone gets... You know, the culture will come back to dump tackles. The culture of dump tackling will come back massively, because people will hit straight, they'll lift people and they'll go on their back, and guess what? Your head hits the floor. So there's caveats to all of this.
And that's something I haven't really considered the idea. I mean, I know that the tip tackle was outlawed, but like you say, you lift somebody off their feet, they panic, they're not going to get the ball away. And like you said, to be fair, I think English cultural rugby, it's not an off. I don't think there's a lot of players with the skills to get a lot of offloads off. I would love to see a world where that is the norm, where you're looking to go into contract and you're thinking about the offload. But I mean, that's not going to happen overnight. One interesting, I think, potential success story is in France, where they did, I think it's level six and below. So that's very low level rugby, really. It's not, we're not. When you're considering that in over it's level three and below in the RFU are doing bringing in, they had it initially made almost no difference at all. A lot of penalties, no real reduction in concussion. The people were still going high constantly, but apparently going to the second season was when they started to see improvements, less penalties. Then the concussion rate came down and they were starting to see a bit more of an expansive offload game, which is maybe some level of, there is light in the tunnel. There is some good idea behind this. It could well work. I mean, only time will tell. And ultimately, if it pays off, if it ends up working and we're all feel a bit silly, going, oh, that was stupid, it's a good thing. Everyone will be glad to have been proved wrong. But people, I think the pushback is people, from what I've heard, and you get the arseholes who are, back in my day, we used to have a fight, game's gone soft. Those arseholes, they aren't worth listening to. But a lot of the pushback I've heard is that people just don't think it will work.
It's an interesting one. I think that the best thing that we've got from this, really, actually, is how involved people have gotten. You know, the fact that a petition got so many signatures, the fact that people now have actually woke up and asked the questions about how their clubs are ran. You know, we were sat there last night and the guys were talking after training about the structure of our club, like who actually has contact with this council, who has a weekly meeting or monthly meeting with them. How do we have that communication bridge with them? You know, one of our 99s players, Patrick Burke, very strong personality, shall we say, very active guy. He actually took to emailing our council representative and put him under a lot of pressure and basically said, you've made a decision really without consulting any of your constituents. This is bad. You know, you should consider your position. And it got a little bit hairy, actually. I know a bit of backlash, but it actually created a dialogue then. And what we've actually done at the club is between myself and Patrick, we put together a questionnaire asking the guys and girls at the club what their thoughts were, what their response were. And we got a huge response to that. And just some of the numbers that came out of that, you know, over 2 in 3, so 2 out of 3 people on the questionnaire, I think we reached over 40, 50 people in the end, would reject the change outright. So that just shows that there's this instantaneous dislike for it anyway.
Yeah.
You know, 88% of people thought they would be less effective as a player. And I think that's the most important one that came out of there. Rugby, it's always this sort of fish, all shapes and sizes kind of thing. And I do think that by putting a law in that really lowers that tackle height and says that's where it has to be, you do alienate a lot of people. You know, the with all due respect, let's call it what it is, that the little fat kids who are coming down to rugby to lose a bit of weight, they struggle to get low. They're going to struggle to get lower. The aging veteran players who can't get down low enough, they're going to go, well, fuck this, I can't be arsed. And it's a shame because we will lose people, unfortunately. And I think also just the emotional side of it, with how upset people have been, that they feel really, really pushed away. And to be honest, I'm still appalled by the way the RFU's reacted. They've kind of almost just said, sorry, you're upset.
Yeah, like, I did think
like a bad boyfriend kind of response. Like, oh, sorry, you're upset that I went out and had a load of beers and started chatting up a load of birds. It's kind of your fault that you're upset, though. Like, fuck you guys. Like, and that's where I'm a bit annoyed with it, to be honest. But we've started this dialogue, and people are now interested in how their clubs run. Like I said, we were talking to our committee last night. What can we do to be more involved in our club? We were talking to RFU representatives and stuff. What can we do to be more involved? And I think the sad reality to a degree is it has kind of shown a little bit that the RFU, it seems like a lot of the top people in the RFU are corporate. And it's really shown now that their interests are in corporate. And I've heard a few people jokingly say this, but I agree with it on an actual, quite a true basis, to be honest. I think that if the RFU, if changing the game would make them more money, then they'd do it. Like, it's not about the game for them, unfortunately. If like taking scrums out would make them more money and sponsorships and revenue, they'd do it. You know what I mean? It's I think that's their interest, and they've shown that now. The fact that you push this kind of decision without even putting like a questionnaire out to players, like, how would you feel about this? Because even if they did it anyway, at least they could say, hey, we sort of ran it by you. You know, you weren't unaware of this.
That's the classic sort of local council, local government approach to things. To say, exactly. Do you want a roundabout? And no, here's a roundabout.
Yeah, it's utter bullshit, though, unfortunately. And the fact that, like, you know, there's 100... We've dropped from 300-odd thousand registered players to 100-odd thousand registered players in just 6 years. And I know COVID's had a huge impact on that, blah, blah, blah. We might recover somewhat. But this kind of thing is not going to help us recover. And Twickenham, in all due respect, it gets full, people go and watch, etc. But the game exists, but the community game. And I think unless they literally just want it to be played by private schools, which maybe that's what they want, I don't know, then this kind of thing's not going to help. And I think you will lose a lot of people to sports like boxing, mixed martial arts, rugby league. You know, they don't play in fucking winter anyway, so they've already got a huge advantage. This will just turn the screw, to be honest. People want to play rugby in the sun. So it's where it's going to go, unfortunately. And that's the biggest worry that I get from it. But I think, overall, it's just a huge disappointment with the way they've treated paying members.
I think we're going to move on to discussing the RFU's general incompetence in a minute, but I'll just quickly give the listeners some homework, some additional listening. It's a good podcast that I listen to about this, discuss it really well. It's the Real Science of Sport podcast. It's a couple of South African guys. One's a sports scientist, one's a sports journalist. The episode is called English Rugby's Controversial New Tackle Law. They pretty much go through everything I've said and go through basically how does it, you know, have a good conversation, and they're more professional than we are, so you might get a bit more out of it. We'll move on swiftly now. As I was saying, the RFU, are they generally quite incompetent? is that too harsh?
No, I disagree. Like, I think, again, like we mentioned about this this brilliant online system that they brought in for like players, registering players. You can see like who's the best away teams. You can see who's top try scorers in leagues, blah, 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 blah. Really great little features. They're not using that to track injuries and stuff like that. Like they drop the ball on a lot of stuff. And like I say, I think it's because they come from a complete corporate mindset. They don't come from a sport mindset. I wonder how many games of rugby Sleepy Bill's even played. If any.
I mean, you made a good point saying, I think if you don't do something, they could easily end up being just a game if they're just happy for it to be private schools, which I think a lot of people, the RFU, probably wouldn't mind, if I'm being perfectly honest.
I think it's opened the dialogue, and I think we, the players of that kind of community level, that the more working class level, if you want to call it that, the lower sort of middle class, blah, 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 whatever you define it as, I think we've realised that we don't actually have that much say at the top of our game, unfortunately. And I think it's woke a lot of people up to go, hey, I need to get involved in this more. And, you know, like I said, we've, as a player group at Derby, we've taken a bit on that to get involved in this decision. You know, I hope that it encourages players across the country of, you know, that sort of under 35 age bracket to get involved a bit more and try and make a bit of a difference. Because, yeah, we're the people who buy the tickets to games. We're the guys who play it every week, and the same for the women's game as well. I think they need to get more involved, because, you know, there's only so much you can do without having that representation and that mindset involved of people who are actually in that bracket. So I think it's important that we get them involved there, because, yeah, I think a lot of people across the board at those positions in the RFU don't actually care about rugby, to be honest. Do they even know anything about rugby? We don't know them. They're faceless individuals. And I think Will Carlin said they were 50 old men who had no fucking clue or whatever it was. So I still think that's quite apparent now.
I think when you look at it, it's weird, isn't it? There's a lot of rough with the smooth, it seems. This GMS, game management system, seems to be quite a good idea. You're getting your player registered, you know, your players who are registered in, who's at what club, go through, you know, matches and things like that. I think it's the same way you go through there as well, with like coaching courses and qualifications and referee qualifications, all of that. Everyone's in the system.
Yeah.
And which I think is good. You can't lie. Keeps people safeguarding way. It keeps people safe. I think, generally speaking, if you're talking about safe, I mean, safeguarding's, it's not a minor issue, but in the grand scheme of the RFU's job, it's not a, it's not really a huge deal. It's not really a, it's a minimum than it is a win, but they are quite good at it. And their investment is a lot of these 4G pitches around the country. Derby have got one.
We have one.
Leicester Forest have got one. People don't really like playing on them, but say what you will, they keep the game going during soggy winters.
Well, you know, I'll put it this way. We didn't have a home game called off over this winter period. So, and that just shows that they work for that. So I think, you know, that they are decent in that regard. I think there's still a little bit of improvement to be made on those, but I think you're right. But the sad thing is, for every two or three good things they do, that seems like there's four or five shit things that they're just not thinking about. And it's a bit like, I mean, I know we were talking before and you've got a couple of little subtopics of things that they've not done well recently. So I reckon let's dive into those and dissect them.
Up until this tackle law thing, the England rugby's biggest headline, Eddie Jones is sacked after the autumn, where England did not bad, to be honest. They brought Steve Borthwick and Kevin Sinfield in from Tigers, cost them a grand sum of over £1 million to bring them both in. Now, I assume that England rugby have got, this is our elite England team budget, and they've got a different, this is the community game budget. But that's £1 million in the RFU that's now gone, which they have essentially pissed away. They've got to pay Eddie Jones out of his contract because they've sacked him, I imagine. I'm sure Eddie Jones is probably a smart enough man to say, okay, if you're going to sack me, you pay me early. His contract was up at the end of the World Cup. It's in October. If you think he's doing that bad a job, sack him, just don't renew his contract at the end of the World Cup if you really want to bring someone else in. You can speak to Steve Borthwick and say, we want you next after the World Cup, and that's up to him. Ball's in his court. He's going to take the job because he already has. But any coach would want the international job. Of course they would.
Well, it's a joke at the minute. I know we're one game into the Six Nations as well, and we've seen that two coaches are leaving at the end of the Six Nations, and you know Wigglesworth is coming in from Tigers. You know, it's just like it's a bit of a shit show. I think whoever works in the comms for the RFU is having a fucking nightmare lately.
Does anybody do the job?
It just doesn't make sense. Like, why say that now? Like, you don't see Ireland doing this. You know, Wales at the moment, Wales are in turmoil. They've had a real bad going over. I'm sure we'll talk about that. You know, but you don't see Scotland and France and that doing this. They'll know if coaches are leaving at the end of the Six Nations, but they're not going to say it after match day one when we've just lost to fucking Scotland for the third year in a bloody row. Do you know what I mean?
I don't know if it's partly...
Are these trying to distract us?
Could be. It could be that. I don't know if I don't work in the media, despite this sort of half-hearted attempt at being in the media.
We're definitely not professionals.
Yeah, but I don't know. There's always, you know, worst kept secrets in any professional sport or any line. Like politics is exactly the same. The media know what's coming out of Downing Street, you know, 48 hours before the rest of us hear it.
Yeah.
So there's probably somebody who works for the Times or the Telegraph or whatever is in the press box at Twickenham who's heard all this stuff and decides they're going to, you know, probably been told it on faith by someone who had a beer after the game or something like that. And they report it and it goes in the paper. It's all out there. It's a talking point. Whether that's right or wrong, I guess, you know, if it's true, it's true. Maybe they have a right. They have a duty to report it. But
rumors are better than... I think the rumours are better than just outright going, yeah, these guys are fucking off in 4 weeks. Why not get rid of them now? Yeah. Why not get rid of them now? If they're not going to be here at the end of the Six Nations, we've only got 8 games before the World Cup, I think. Maybe less. I might be wrong. Might even be less than that. You know, we've only got that many games before the World Cup. Are you really telling me that that's enough time to bed it in? It might be, it might not be. But what's the point in having Cocker's there now if he's not going to be involved in 6 months?
Yeah, which is a fair point. And also, that's another job because then you've got the end of the Six Nations, then you've got the 2 or 3 warm-up games where you've got to get a new forwards coach in, which is not exactly a small job, is it? It's not like it's you know, it's the hitman's gone or it's the Clive Woodward's eye coach who was teaching the visual recognition. If he's leaving at the end of the Six Nations, yeah, well, you know, I think the forwards coach is probably it seems in professional rugby the third most important man on the coaching squad. I mean, just go back to even the reasoning behind sacking Eddie Jones. To me, I guess from the outside, because I don't know anybody at the RFU, but as an insider, as a rugby fan, it seemed to come from dissenting voices on the terraces going, oh, bloody, this Eddie's messed it up, isn't he? Oh, they'll be better without him in the squad. Because you look at how England did over the last... They won a series in the summer. Mm-hmm. You can argue Australia aren't the best team going, but you can only beat who you play.
You've still got to go there and win.
And they went and did it. The England team, literally the squad of players, England are in a changing period. They're not the same squad they were 4 years ago.
No.
And that, if you pick that squad from 4 years ago to play in this World Cup, they're not going to do as well. That was a very good England team, probably the best England team since England won the World Cup. Probably the best performance England have had. Obviously the best performance England have had since they won the World Cup. Hmm. They were probably the best team there apart from on one day in Yokohama in the final, where South Africa just turned up in the knockout rounds and beat everyone. But Eddie Jones did a good job after a bad Six Nations beforehand. You look at them now, there's a lot of new players in the team. The likes of, I mean, Freddie Stewart's hit the ground running, fair enough, but Jack Van Portfleet at scrum half, his second game is against New Zealand. Doesn't have the best game of his life, but he's, what, 21 years old? And he's going to be all the better for having played, if he was in the World Cup squad, you know, this year coming now, for having a year of international rugby under his belt. Yes, you can carry on picking Ben Youngs and Danny Kerr, but then if he's then in the World Cup squad, he's a, you know, 1-2 caps.
Yeah, I think that was the issue that a lot of people had with Eddie. Like the team hadn't changed all that much. And I think one thing that's kind of, you know, people got on side with Borthwick with early doors is that, you know, a couple of faces were dropped. You know, Billy Vunipola has been told to, you know, you're probably going to go to the World Cup, Billy. You're playing pretty well for Saracens, but we want to see someone else right now and things like that. But then a few same faces run again. And I know there's rules on who we can and can't pick, but I think, yeah, I just think we're sort of in the trap of at the moment where nothing's really going to change that much. I think people assume. Change. No, I think people Eddie's assume last, it's going to be better.
Yeah, Eddie's last squad had a lot of young faces in it. Like I said, Van Portfleet, I mean, Stewart has played well for a little while. Again, he's been brought in by Eddie Jones. Marcus Smith's been given a chance by Eddie Jones. People are saying, oh, can Marcus Smith and Farrell play together? Well, they played together at the weekend. And I mean, England lost. They didn't do terribly. Other people, Arundel has been brought in. A lot of new players in the pack who some have, some haven't worked for Eddie Jones. But you can't, that's the point of these internationals. I know they're not friendlies in the same way that they are in football, but you've got to build your squad ready to go to a World Cup. And that's the end of the cycle. That's what ultimately the coaches are employed to do, is to go and do the best they can at the World Cup. And I don't think Eddie Jones did anything wrong at all to deserve being sacked, other than he wasn't a yes man and enough people were going that the RFU felt they could get rid of him. But again, like I said, they've probably pissed up about £2 million up the wall. Now he's going to go coach Australia at the World Cup, cutting easily knocking them out.
Yeah. It's written in the bloody, in the stars now, isn't it, unfortunately, to quote Gary Neville.
Yeah, I mean... And it's one of these things where you could argue if a change needs to happen, you're best making it even at a bad time than you are not making it and waiting. And if they wanted Borthwick and that was their only time to get in, which I can hardly see that being the case because what other jobs are you going to go on to? There is that, you know, like I said, it's that case where the right, there is no right time to make these hard decisions, but I just can't see what it actually achieves. I think Steve Borthwick has got the pretty much the exact same squad. I know I've heard this somewhere, I don't know if it's true, they could only make like or add four new players or something, so he can't even make a wild new squad if he wanted to, although one of his players was Dan Cole, so you can argue he credits him, he's played well for Tigers. And I've been a critic of Dan Cole in the past, that he's not a well-rounded rugby player. He's an excellent prop forward.
I just love the hatred at the moment of Tigers again, because like it's so many Tigers players in the squad, and obviously the coaches have gone from Tigers in
Champions of England. What can you say?
Champions of England,
the best team. And we did a podcast 2 years ago slagging them off, and then Borthwick comes in and turns them around.
Well, look, maybe this is the thing with England. They've gone, hey, we need to make this change before the World Cup, you know, because to be honest, I think. Even with, saying there's a bit of a change, whatever, going into this World Cup, you need to perform at the World Cup. And if Eddie had gone and we hadn't got out the group or we got knocked out in the quarterfinals, that would be an abject failure, because you've got to grade him against how he's performed previously, new squad or not. And, you know, he's won Six Nations. He did really well in Autumn Series before. He's, you know, got to a World Cup final. So that's all you've got to grade him off. And to be honest, it slipped a bit from there. But I think, to be honest, doing any sort of sporting job in the UK is incredibly difficult to do for as long as he did. I think, how long was he in charge for? Since 2015, I think he came in after the World Cup. So 2016, let's call it. Six years performing at that level in a top performance at that job is, to be honest, in British culture, unheard of. There's very few managers in football, rugby, cricket who last that long.
Yeah. Well, also, what Eddie Jones did was take a pretty... Well, I won't say I always thought they were crapping the team, a team that underperformed.
Well, they were demoralised. You know,
very, very quickly turned them around from being out of the group stage exit of our own World Cup, no good in the Six Nations, playing dross rugby, to all of a sudden being a team that was attacking, that was dangerous, that would score in a few more tries, won the Six Nations. I mean, they win it twice.
They've won it twice of him, yeah.
Yeah. World Cup final.
They won a Grand Slam in France as well, didn't they?
Yeah.
As the coach. You know, World Cup final, beat New Zealand in the semi-final.
They beat all of the big Southern Hemisphere teams under his
Won a series in Australia twice,
But like I say, 100% the England team is not as strong as it was, I think, of the last World Cup team. But it is a squad in a state of change. It has to be, because people get old, people can't be in the team.
Yeah.
You have to be thinking, well, there's another, you know, rugby isn't just happened today. It happens in 10 years' time, and you need to have the squad's always going to be changing. And I think Eddie Jones was just doing that. He was overseeing that. He was identified good young players and brought them into the team. Not all of them will pay off. Not all of them will have, you know, the same careers that someone like Farrell or Ben Youngs has had, who have been in the squad for the last 10 years or more. But, you know, it's giving these players an opportunity. And I think, I mean, the worst case scenario, I think, for England and the RFU now is England come fifth. We saw Italy, we'll move on to Italy in a second. They could lose to Italy very easily. This Italy team are not poo. And England could easily get a wooden spoon. I say easily. It's not impossible for England to get a wooden spoon, go to the World Cup, be garbage again out in the group stage, out in the quarterfinals or something.
And Borthwick goes and
you go.
And Eddie Jones comes back.
What was the point in that? and I'm not saying that is going to happen. I obviously don't want that to happen. I think England just do have enough about them to, you know, Scotland are a decent team. But England have got enough about them to beat anybody in the Six Nations, as it turns out, probably anybody does.
Yeah,
again, by that, it's not unthinkable that they can lose every game. I was in Cardiff on Saturday. Wales didn't look brilliant, I'll be honest. But they always raise the game for England, don't they?
Yeah, I think when you compare England to the other unions other than Wales at the moment, Ireland have got this really good model with how they centralise their player contracts and look after their players, bloody, bloody, blah. Scotland are in a position now that they are harvesting players from around the world, let's be brutally honest, which England and co have done before themselves, but not quite to that level, perhaps. And they're doing really well at that. England's approach at the moment isn't very good when you can take the Premiership. But this is why the Premiership's the best league. If you compare the Premiership to the URC, to the top 14, the actual quality of that league is much higher. But again, this transfers into, like we said before, things like Europe and things like that, because their model is different. And this transfers into the way England play as well. So that there's things to consider there. Maybe that's, again, where the RFU should be looking at investing their time and energy at the elite game. You know, the one problem we've got is that these teams are all ran by individual owners and such, and they have their own interests at heart. And there's a real fight there that's going on between those two entities. I think we need to start having a thought process of, do we want our national team to be the best in the world? If we do, then we need to rethink how our club sides and our international industry, if you want to call it, our international setup, are communicating and working together. You know, I've heard a lot of great ideas recently around, you know, even like, because inside centre is a really weak position for England at the moment, around giving clubs more money to push English players through at that position rather than, you know, signing another player. So giving them £100,000 wage cap allowance to keep a player who's good there rather than buying in a foreign player or something like that. So there's a lot of different things we could do. I think we start getting into a bit like arcade and comic book sort of thought processes then, with all these crazy bloody ideas and whatnot. But I think the overarching issue is, when you compare England, the RFU to the IRFU, there's a huge difference in the way we run things. And that is now being seen on the pitch and with the performances that we're seeing.
I mean, I think the IRFU, the Irish, have got an advantage that they've got four centrally controlled professional teams. So it's not really an issue. The issues that England have, they don't have. One could argue the RFU back in the 90s could well be deemed at fault for this, with how the professional structure went. It didn't take enough control, whereas the Irish provinces were all immediately controlled by the IRFU, the same way it was in New Zealand. And if you're looking at teams that have consistently got a great pipeline over the last 20 years, it's probably Ireland and New Zealand and South Africa.
Mm-hmm. And what have they got in common? There's involvement from their governing body that's down to even grassroots level of facilitating players through and such, which we don't have in the UK.
Which we don't have. I think Wales sort of have it, but Wales have got the unfortunate position of having just a small population, really.
And being massive sexists and misogynists.
As it turns out, horrible, horrible people. but when you probably look at it, I think the Welsh national team, realistically outperform where they ought to be compared to these bigger nations. I mean, Ireland's not massive, is it? But there's more people in Ireland than there is in Wales.
Well, the money that they've got knocking about in Ireland is definitely a lot more budget-wise than what's knocking about in Wales.
It goes down to the old-fashioned thing. It's a posh boys game in Ireland. It's a working-class game in South Wales. And that does make a difference. But, you know, where they have those centrally controlled provinces or regions or whatever the teams happen to call them, the national team is ultimately the end goal. That's what they're worried about. And England are in competition with their clubs. And I mean, as it's proven as well, we've seen, this is another episode in itself. We won't get into it now, but Worcester and Wasps
I was about to say, we're getting really morbid here, Dav. We're getting really boring. We need to have some fun
Professor
stuff.
Rugby's
get, let's get the people back. It is a little bit.
The RFU have got to do something. Maybe it's, that is the, I don't know. I mean, I would say centrally controlled the English league is the best way, but I don't trust the RFU.
No, I don't trust them to run a piss up in a brewery, let alone run a league. So, hey ho. I think, yeah, that's the issue. There's just so many different bodies when you compare it. Yeah, like there's the Premiership rugby, then there's RFU, then there's, you know, the European Cup. You know, there's all these different bodies that run themselves. And you kind of get it in football as well, where there's like this sort of real weird kind of vibe around it all, where one competition's pulling this way, another's pulling that way. And it's just a little bit, yeah, there's almost like infighting and, you know, how things are ran. But yeah, enough of this boring stuff, Dav. What's some fun stuff? Tell me about Cardiff. Did you get on the beers? Did you see, yakidar it a little bit? Were you eating leeks and necking pints?
No leeks. It was very good. I went with my brother. I've been to Cardiff a few times for internationals, but yeah, lost my Six Nations virginity, which was very good fun. We went to see the live show of, I think it's fair to say, a rival podcast on the Friday night in Cardiff. We went to see the socially distant sports bar, which I do recommend if anyone has never heard of it, listen to it. It's hilarious. And yeah, a little bit hungover, a little bit delicate on Saturday morning, but soldiered on down to St. Mary's Street, walk about, a couple of Guinness at 11:30 in the morning.
Nice.
And then by the time kickoff came around, sort of just about drank the hangover away. It seems to not matter what game or what time of year it is, what competition, the beer at the Millennium Stadium is below par. It's very not good. And then, yeah, what's the game was very, Ireland look very good. Very, very good.
They play nice rugby at the minute.
Yeah. I mean, from watching in the stand, you do see a bit more than you do on TV, so at least when you have, you know, as seasoned eyes and you know what you're talking about as much as I do.
When you've got the beer goggles on.
Yes. But Ireland, without really doing anything amazing, without pulling up a load of trees, scored 34 points, I think they finished on. And they raced away in the first half, and it looked a bit like men against boys. I think Wales are obviously missing Sean Edwards still. I think he's probably the real loss. I think they brought back Warren Gatland. I think Sean Edwards is the one they need to bring back, because they were misslipping off tackles. I think if Sean Edwards was watching that game, he'd pulled his hair out. Well, what he has left. Six Nations rugby. It was a good atmosphere, good friendly atmosphere, actually. Interestingly, obviously the Welsh famous sing-songers, I think their anthem was taken away from them by WRU, so they couldn't sing the line.
Yeah, look at you now, blaming the RFU even for Welsh problems. Fucking down with the RFU. Just pure hatred.
But of course, 99, an official anthem, Fields of Athenry, shared with the Irish. Ringing around Cardiff quite a bit. So it was a good friendly atmosphere, I enjoyed it.
Yeah, well, you know, we said this earlier on, but I'm going to repeat it now again, not to be controversial, but just to say how it is. The only reason they've banned that song, Delilah that being, is because they've been called out for being a misogynist, sexist organisation. So someone's popped in, some HR representative or equality officer or something has popped up and gone, hey, maybe we can not sing this song anymore in the stadium and make a big deal out of it, because then that will show that we're not sexist or misogynist.
I mean,
basically, that's it. Let's be brutally honest about it. That's why they've done it. It's got nothing to do with them actually giving a fuck. They only do things to look better and get people back on side, because the WRU are very unpopular before all this stuff's come out, and now they're literally rock bottom. I mean, thank goodness for the RFU. The WRU exists.
One point I will add on as well, the WRU being as, if not more, incompetent or perhaps worse than the RFU, they ran out of food before kickoff. Me and my brother went to get a pie, and they're going, oh, sorry, we got no pies, no food at all, really. Like, what have you got? Well, hot dogs. It's like the shittest hot dog I've had in my life, and it cost £7. So,
that pisses me off. I mean, I hate going to stadiums sometimes. I love being at live sport and all that, but some stadiums, it's utter shite.
You know what's really irritating as well? Because we went to Cardiff Arms Park, which, if you've never been, is literally part of the same.
It's where the Blues play, isn't it?
Yeah, where Cardiff Blues play. Not the Blues anymore, though, just Cardiff again. No. They had a wood-fired pizza oven thing in their like fan park, which was a bit generous. It was like there was from Portaloos, a bar, and a band that never started playing. We went in the club bar at Cardiff, to be fair. It was very nice in there. And we both said, oh, should we go get pizza? And we thought, no, we'll make sure we get in time. There'll be food in there. Went into the ground, and it was... I'd rather have licked the toilet, I think, than the hot dog I ended up getting, but never mind.
Well, you would have soaked up that lovely watered-down beer somehow.
Yeah, it did taste a bit... It was very tinny as well. It is literally out of a tin, but you could taste it. Like it was.
Oh, that's the
guy
worst
behind thing. Setting all these Amstels out. There was a bar that did Guinness, but the queue was a mile long.
Yeah, because it's actual proper beer. Fucking, oh, I don't know. Stadiums are terrible, really. Like, I remember being at Twickenham, and it was £7 for a plastic bottle of Carling. £7 for a bottle. It's just not value for money, but they know they've got you. It pisses me off because they know they've got you as a captive audience. They know that you can't get through watching your team lose or play shit without being pissed.
So maybe that is where the fans need to change and say, you know what, let's just go and watch rugby and enjoy it, and let's not be steaming whilst it's happening.
Well, I've heard good things about Guinness Zero. You know, this podcast, this team's had a history of, you know, not knocking the non-alcoholic beverages. I've heard good things. I've heard good things.
I had some on Saturday, but like, we were giving out little shot glasses of it.
Mm.
But I was already half cut when I got given it. And then...
So your body just confused it with real alcohol?
I had a sip. Oh, that tastes a bit like Guinness. And then went and ordered a proper Guinness. So, you know... advertising worked. It made me buy a Guinness product, but it just wasn't.
It's on all the post protectors. I think this is what's great about Guinness. Guinness don't give a shit. They're like, we're just going to push this product like massively. Yeah. They're marketing. I mean, Guinness probably has arguably the best marketing of any alcohol brand out there. Arguably any brand. They're the best marketers out there. The adverts that they do have always been amazing, and their campaigns are great. And I think the belief in their product is always really impressive as well. Like I remember they brought it out a year or two ago, and they went, actually, we're not going to launch this. There was all this hubbub that they were going to launch it, and they went, do you know what? We've tasted this, and it's not good enough. We're not doing it. And they shipped it off and went away. But, you know, the only other game of the weekend was Italy-France, which was a very enjoyable game. France, you said earlier on, they were the best team in the world. Didn't really look like it. I mean, they did an attack, you know, some really, really great attacking play. The way in which they are recycling and moving the ball is just what you'd expect, really. It's kind of that Racing sort of mix with Toulouse kind of top 14 style of play with some really nice interchanges and sort of open play moves and whatnot. But defensively, they didn't look great. Really struggled to slow down Italy. Italy were just playing with, you know, real good quick ball just on the front foot consistently, which got them into the game really well and got them the tries that they scored. Angie Capuozzo could, you know, step Mr. Blobby in a telephone box. The guy has got feet like you've never seen. It was, you know, unbelievable finish getting on the outside of Aldrit when really he had no right to. So I think Italy, the question is, have they arrived? I mean, they arrived a long time ago because they have beaten these teams before. They've beaten France before and such. But you know, it feels like they've arrived again almost. I know they lost, but they really had a chance to win the game. So they're building towards something. I wouldn't be surprised to see them beat England this weekend if England are still struggling to be at their best. But usually England do play pretty well against Italy and they do sort of ignite in that game. So maybe it's a chance for England to ignite there. But yeah, I think Italy look really dangerous. Nicest kit that I've seen for a long time as well.
Throwaway kit, wasn't it? The white with the
green
and red
highlights. And the Italian flag making up the sort of shoulder panels. But they played really well. Juan Ignacio Brex loves a carry. He carries Wellard. Capoezzo's got great feet. The front row are starting to really fire for them. I mean, you know, Italy have always had a pretty decent tight five, but they look better. They look well drilled. So they might be in a place where they're organised enough and they've kind of got the organisation to push on. France, I think for them, maybe just was a little bit of a first day hangover on the Six Nations. They've got a huge game this weekend. You know, it's basically the Six Nations decider this weekend, I think, although don't write Scotland off. But I think, you know, these two are the favourites. So, but France going to Ireland, going to be difficult for them. They've two away games to start the Six Nations. For them, really, Italy and Ireland are probably the two worst, you know, opening away games for them, because Italy are going to play out of their skin. They're going to try and play above themselves. And Ireland are probably the best team in the world right this second, in my opinion, just the way that they're playing. So it could be Ireland's to lose. I don't know. It's interesting.
I think, I haven't seen the France game because I was on the train back from Cardiff, feeling sorry for myself. But it certainly feels like, obviously, Italy beating Australia in the autumn.
Mm-hmm.
And this result here, yes, they've lost, but you know, they're running France all the way and being, you know, 4 meters from scoring a winner. It does, and not as well, it wasn't, doesn't sound, obviously, I haven't seen it. You said they're a bit lax in defense or what have you, but they attacked, France attacked fairly well. So this isn't like France came out, had a big lunch and sort of shit their pants a bit and were a bit sluggish, a bit crap. And Italy kicked 25 points that kept them in the game, and then France scored again at the end when they turned it on eventually. Mm. It looks like France, Italy, sorry, gave them a game, took them on toe-to-toe. They scored, what, three tries?
Yeah, they did. And they played from everywhere almost. Yeah. They were literally, you kind of felt like, and to their own detriment sometimes, it kind of felt a little bit like when Bristol first came up into the Prem, where you never knew whether that pass on their own 5 meter line was going to stick and they were going to make a break, or if someone was just going to drop it and some, you know, second row was going to plop on it for the opposition and a try was scored. There's a little bit of that. They were doing, you know, they noticed that Dupont defends in the line quite a lot. He doesn't really sweep deep. So they were chipping the box kick from just on the edge of the 22 into that kind of midfield area, which is really, really risky. It's kind of like going for it on fourth down every time, you know, or never punting it, or only ever punting it short, hoping that, you know, they spill the ball or some stuff, you know, American football kind of mindset. But it's kind of like that, really. It's kind of like playing those really low percentage, high risk, high reward plays. And I think maybe that's what Italy are kind of finding as their identity, you know, kind of like Argentina in that respect, where they're like, well, you know what? We're not probably as good as these guys every single day. But if we get 20% of the 10 things that we try and attack, that's going to equal two tries, which gets us in the game. So maybe that's what they're doing. Maybe a little bit more calculated rather than just risky stuff nowadays, because before they kind of just threw caution to the wind. But now it seems like there's a plan behind the madness, a bit of method to the madness for them.
Maybe this is, I feel like, with Argentina, I think we kind of felt like they were on the cusp for a while. It's just probably where we were really growing up. So they didn't have quite the understanding, but they felt like they really arrived in 2007 at that World Cup, where obviously they came third. And Italy, it probably maybe feels like that now, where they're actually taking teams on.
Mm.
Whereas they've huffed and puffed and got a win here or there before, now it's they will play teams and have a game plan to beat teams. And now we see Argentina are a team that you don't think you're going to beat every time.
Yeah, exactly.
If if Italy can get to that point, especially when we've been talking about should they be dipped out of the Six Nations because they're just not competing, I mean, to turn it around in the course of essentially 2 years is unreal by whoever's, whatever work is at play there, whether it's, you know, a structural thing, it's the Italian Federation, or if it's the, whatever the coaching staff they've got in, or they've just got a good crop of players. I know they've had strong under 20 teams for the last 5 or 6 years. They've done, when you look at the Six Nations under 20s results, you go, oh, Italy, they've got some wins there, which you wouldn't think of. Maybe it's just those players coming through now. I'm not sure. But hopefully it's better for the game in general to have a strong Italy.
Yeah, and yeah, for sure.
Long may it last.
Yeah. So, in summary, RFU, sack your communications head. Absolute nightmare. You know, sort it out. Sleepy Bill, is his job in risk? Who knows? We'll see down the line. You know, let's get some young blood in the RFU potentially at some point. The WRU, massive sexist as misogynists and haters of Tom Jones.
Can't organise, it turns out, not even a piss up in a brewery, but in a stadium.
Yeah. Sort out your horrible cans amp still, you bastards. And the final thing is we're back. We're doing this again. We're actually taking this seriously again. We're trying to raise the profile for the team. You know, it's a new season, a lot of stuff happening, new sponsors coming in, new kit, things of the like. We're going to be hitting tournaments across the country again this year, showing up on the domestic stage, the 99s, the most social team on the elite circuit, keeping true to our colours, keeping true to our mantras and delivering that ice cold, creamy style that the people love so much. We're back, baby. We're having fun. I think the podcast, we're going to look to try and have the players on, and you know, whether we do this weekly or bi-weekly, bear with us. We're going to try and figure it out again, which fits in with our busy lives, our packed schedules that we have, you know. Dav plays football on a Monday night. He's a busy bloke. He goes to the Millennium Stadium on a Saturday. You know, he's a man of culture, a man of Amstel. Walk about 11 in the morning, pint of Guinness, followed by a Guinness Zero Chaser. He loves it. But
so I embrace at least five cultures, I think, in Cardiff. I am a whatever the opposite of a Philistine
is. Mr. Worldwide.
I am the pit bull Renaissance, of North man. Yorkshire.
The Renaissance man. But yeah, look, we're back. The podcast, we're going to look to get the players involved. I think we're going to go on a model of getting them to come with a topic, something that's pissing them off with rugby or life in general. And we're going to put the world to rights every week, because nothing we love more than playing rugby and having a good time is moaning about it. So long may that continue. And we're back. We're ready to go.
Right, we will see you next week. It's good to be back. I've got to end the recording because Zoom is kicking us off.
So yes. We're going to change our platform. Fuck you, Zoom. You've ruined it. You've ruined your
chances. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.
The 99's Rugby, 99s.7s@gmail.com. Email, get in touch. Boom.